G'day folks, talk to Kyle Baker, a police officer, a sergeant, that supervises a unit within a task force that combats human trafficking in Northern California. Important work stopping criminals from exploiting children, women, men, an unfortunate reality that he shares and teaches of these experiences across his state and looking at taking these training methods across the US. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you want to become a patron and roll with the squad, that'd be great. And want to thank our sponsors. Permanbil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Oh, yeah.
So we're recording, brother.
All right, let's do it.
Let's do it. Kyle Baker, police sergeant, fighter of human trafficking. Thanks for jumping on the podcast and having a yarn with us, brother.
Well, I appreciate it. It's super good to connect, especially worldwide, and have a chat kind of about what's going on in the world of human trafficking and, you know, highlighting some of the things that folks are doing out there to fight it. So I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, because I think it's really important, you know, how and what you're doing in California, but just how a lot of this translates to worldwide to a lot of other countries. I know it acts in different degrees, but, you know, a lot of people can relate, and I think it's really important work that you're doing, so appreciate it. So sounds like you're pretty busy. You know, you're a police sergeant up in sunny California there, so, and you're also a teacher, so how's that going in general?
It's good, you know. So I've been a police officer for going on 12 years now, and I work in a city and a county that's basically halfway between Sacramento and San Francisco. So I'm in the greater Bay Area. And I think why that's important to talking about human trafficking is I'm almost in this big network, this big freeway of, unfortunately, trafficking that happens in Northern California, where we'll meet folks from Southern California, from Nevada, Reno, Las Vegas, that all seem to travel where I work through. So that's kind of the area that I work in. And then as far as what I do on a daily basis, I supervise a unit that combats human trafficking. That's our main objective, our main goal. I work on a task force here in the county of Contra Costa where I work, which is ran by our district attorney's office. They take human trafficking very seriously. So I work with a bunch of folks around the county. And then just because I've been doing this now specifically for 6 or 7 years or so, which has been a blessing and a curse, because it's been great to help and rescue victims and, you know, hold exploiters accountable. But at the same time, you know, unfortunately, seen some pretty bad stuff. So I share those experiences now up and down the state of California with police officers, prosecutors, victim advocates. Really anybody that'll listen. And I love sharing just with folks and out in the community, whether it's here locally or now internationally, and just having a chat of what human trafficking is and how we can collectively combat it.
Yeah, that's it. And that's the word there, collectively, you know, when you're working with other organizations, just with that common goal. And yeah, it's a tricky situation, you know, when you're looking at a lot of these people getting exploited, which is it's just nuts, you know. So, and how's the weather in general over there? Because, like, there's stuff like that you combat too when you got the crazy California fires and everything else going on over there. So how is it at the moment?
Oh yeah. So to give you a kind of a perspective. So, I mean, I can't complain too much about the weather here in California. You know, we see somewhat of the four seasons, but, you know, usually it's one extreme or the other. Either we have a good and wet winter, or like this winter, we didn't get a lot of rain. And why that's scary, and you bring up something definitely significant that we've faced in Northern California, it's those fires. And I've personally worked a couple of those through mutual aid in the areas like, you know, in the Napa Valley, that had those horrible fires, you know, the last few years, and talk about some devastating stuff, you know, to see people's homes gone and businesses and things of those nature. So, it always in California seems to be something going on. And you're right. Mm. Those fires can be damaging.
Yeah. Pretty full on. Yeah. At the moment here in New South Wales, we're dealing with a lot of floods at the moment, actually, just the rain's coming down pretty hard and heavy. So, but, and a lot of folks are losing their homes and whatnot, which is no good. So
it is wintertime there currently.
Yeah, it's getting close. It's just, we're autumn now. So it just trickled over into autumn, but sort of from when you're looking at north of Sydney to southern Queensland, you're looking at, yeah, there's heavy rainfall. So a lot of folks are going under because there's a lot of floodplains up the east coast of Australia, which is no good. So, yeah, it's not good at all, brother. But
yeah, sending prayers and love your way.
Yeah, cheers, brother. And also, like, what drew you into, before going into the important work you're doing with human trafficking, when you're looking at the police force itself, so what drew you into saying, hey, yeah, I'm going to, you know, put on the uniform and give this a crack. This is something that I really want to do. So what pulled you into that?
So I had a personal connection. My father was a police officer, and he was a police officer for 28 years. And so I grew up around it. I lived his good days. I lived his bad days. And I was attracted, I think, really to two main things. Number one, helping people. And a lot of times you'll hear that and some will say it's cliche, but it's not. That's why we do this job. We're there for folks that are having the worst days of their lives, and we're there to try to get them through that and make it better. And then additionally, it's just a fun and dynamic job. You know, I've gotten to travel. I've gotten to meet people. I've gotten to learn. I've gotten to make mistakes. I've had successes. I've had failures. I've had good days, bad days. So I think what keeps, you know, me coming to work are the folks I work with, the good men and women, the community I work in, and just the overall notion of being there for people.
Yeah, 100%. You know, we need the boys in blue getting around, you know, in whether it's in California and the rest of America or Australia and where we are, you know, because you have people where, you know, where there's been a lot of talk about, and you would have seen it obviously over where you are, like with defund the police and all this sort of stuff, but hey, we need that balance, you know. So we're at the end of the day, we're helping folks out to make sure that, you know, a lot of this important work gets done, like especially when you're looking at human trafficking, because, you know, if we don't have people like yourself, like, you know, then it's just going to get overrun with all sorts of stuff, and, you know, more people are going to get exploited. So what was the recruitment process like when, you know, because it's different in every country and I suppose in different states in America. So when you're going through the recruitment and training up through the academy, what's that like with the police force?
Yeah, so everyone has a maybe a little bit different journey before they become police officers. You know, some folks go to the military, some go to college, some work different jobs. You know, we have folks like me that started law enforcement when I was 21. And then we'll have folks that it'll be their second career and come in at 35, 40, you know, whatever it is. So usually the journey to get there is a little different, but once you do get there, it's generally the same. Here in California, we have a 6-month police academy. And so what a lot of times most folks will do is they'll, you know, say, I want to be a police officer. I'll jump online maybe and say, okay, who's hiring? Which right now is everybody. So shout out to any of your listeners out there looking for a job. There's plenty to be had for police officers in California and probably everywhere. But yeah. You know, you hook up with the agency you want to work for. You go through usually an interview process, a background investigation, you know, a medical checkup, make sure you're all good there. And then once you pass all that, you go to the academy. And the academy is definitely intensive. It's 6 months long, 5 days a week, 8-hour days. And, you know, it has that structure of somewhat of a boot camp, if you will, in the beginning, you know, mm-hmm. where discipline's expected, You show up looking good, making sure your uniform's dialed in, and you start at the basics of law enforcement. A lot of academic stuff goes into it. But then as time goes on, you work on all your different skills, your driving and your defensive tactics, your interview skills, all kinds of different learning domains go into it. It's very comprehensive. And so that lasts about 6 months. And then you get to cross that stage at graduation, you know, after a long 6 months with your pals, and then you're off and running into the police department.
And how'd that feel like once you got through the academy and it's like, right, got the badge now, next step?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny, you know, because most academies, you know, you're always on the hunt for your cadre, for your instructors, because, you know, you want to, if you're not doing what you're supposed to do, you're going to hear about it. So when you first cross that stage, and then for like a week after, even when you go to the police department, and you know nobody's going to come, you know, up yelling at you because your boots aren't perfect in the back, you know, you're still kind of on edge and you know, wondering when the instructors are going to come get you. But so that feeling's pretty fun. And you also run everywhere in the academy a lot of times, you know, just kind of part of it. So you realize, hey, I can walk again. You know, I don't have to be sprinting from my car inside. So once you get over those kind of little things, it's a huge relief. But I'll tell you, it with that comes great responsibility, right? And now you're actually out there doing the job. You're actually wearing the badge. You're going to calls for service. You know, you're encountering danger. It definitely, there's a huge shock that comes with that you work through during that original kind of 4 month field training program, which happens after you start.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's pretty full on, but you know, it creates that discipline, hey, to move forward, and like where you've created that discipline and looking at some of the various roles that you've held through the force, even SWAT. So what are some of those experiences like?
Yeah, so I've been super lucky. I work for a great agency in a great county. And, you know, I started off when I started in 2010, I started working patrol, you know, so I'd be the guy out in the black and white car, going to calls for service, you know, making traffic stops, going to traffic and accidents, things of those nature. And I did that for probably the first two and a half years. And you got to do that. You have to have that foundation of patrol. That's really where you learn to talk to folks. You learn how to investigate things. You learn how to have good officer safety. It's a lot of fun. And I tell people that all the time. I mean, you get a job where you go every day and you don't know what's going to happen. It could be a very, slow day, or you could be going, you know, 1 minute you're going to a house that's on fire, you know, next thing you're going to somebody with a gun at a store, or you could be going, become some older lady doesn't know how to turn off her stove and you're going to go help because that's the kind of agency that we are. We're a full service agency. So those first 2.5 years were in the patrol division. And then shortly after that, started working different special assignments. That included our street crimes unit, which was like a proactive unit. And we're specifically going out there to the parts of the town that are having issues, maybe issues with gangs, narcotics, vehicle theft, firearms, shootings, that kind of thing. And we're providing that extra patrol to that area. So that was a blast. That was a lot of fun. A lot of learning went on there. Around that time, I started taking kind of a training role at the police department, as well as our police academy here in the county, for things like defensive tactics, which is like, you know, learning to protect yourself with your hands and everything, in case, you know, somebody attacks you. And then through all that, 2013, I was selected to go to the SWAT team. So now I'm going on my ninth year of being on SWAT. I'm currently our team leader. I've probably been on 30, 35 different callouts over the years. Everything from mundane ones, you know, where maybe it's a search warrant at a house, or nothing's mundane, but, you know, maybe a search warrant at a house for a bad guy, and they come out like most of them do, and everything's very calm and chill and no problems. And then I've been on some very chaotic ones, you know, guys, you know, that have shot at the police, or, you know, lit their own house on fire, just crazy stuff. And so those experiences have taught me a lot, you know, about leadership, about, you know, taking stock in your folks and making sure, you know, I'm really big on the leadership principle of finding people that can take your job. Right. So, you know, the more that I can train guys around me to step into these leadership roles, the less I have to do and the more that they get to take on and experience. So those have taught me a lot through that. And then the whole human trafficking thing has been a huge focus for me that probably started about 2016 or so.
Yeah. And that's what I wanted to jump in. And that's good that you're saying that too, you know, putting stock into your folks, like high tide raises all canoes, right? You know, so when individuals rise up, and, you know, when you're working as a collective. So what, you know, you're a fighter of human trafficking, but what experiences drove you into the line of human trafficking? Because obviously you've seen a lot of stuff. So,
yeah, it's a good question. And I'll tell you, it was almost pure accident that it happened. And, you know, I was selected as detective in 2016, and, you know, I came up to our specialized team that deals with gangs, human trafficking, narcotics, and I was originally selected as a narcotics detective, you know. So you've seen all the big movies, and yep, you know, you go up in this role and you're like, okay, you know, here I am. I'm the new narcotics detective. You know, we're going to go out and we're going to take down the biggest drug busts in history. And that's the attitude you go into it with, right? You don't like drug dealers. No, the community doesn't like drug dealers. So, hey, let's go get them and let's, you know, let's get them, held accountable for their actions and get some drugs off the street. And I still love doing that. And that's certainly been a part of my career. But when I first became a detective, that was my mindset. Like, okay, cool. You know, let's go out and get all the drug dealers. Well, it happened to be that one particular week, the detective in our unit that works human trafficking was on vacation. And I remember one of my bosses coming in and saying, hey, I got something you need to take a look at. And I'm like, oh, cool. You know, who's selling what drugs? And he's like, no. Like, this is me a little bit different, but it's a human trafficking case.
Okay.
And I'm like, what? Human traffic? Like, so somebody's driving some humans around? Like, you're saying traffic. Like, what does that even mean? And at the time, I had no idea. And you know, I'm sure we'll get into it later of you know, kind of some misconceptions about human trafficking. But I certainly wasn't knowledgeable in it at all. And he's like, yeah, you know, I need you to go talk to somebody, you know, one of our employees who worked missing persons. Got a call from a young girl. She's about 14 or 15 years old. I got a call from her mom and said, hey, you know, my daughter, she was missing for a while. She's now in juvenile hall for a battery. You know, she assaulted somebody, but it sounds like she was maybe a victim of human trafficking. And I said, okay, well, let me go over and talk to her. So I remember vividly, like it was yesterday. It was my first human trafficking interview in 2016. And it was a young girl that I sat in front of, talked to her for probably about 2 hours. And it was one of the best and most difficult interviews I had had up to that point. Here's this young girl, and, you know, we're at juvenile hall because she had these other crimes going on, right? And nobody knew about the fact she was being trafficking. So as soon as we all knew she had been trafficked, we did the proper things to get her the assistance and help that she needed for sure. But until then, nobody knew about it, right? So I remember sitting across from her and having her tell me that, you know, she essentially was picked up at a town nearby by a couple of adults, men, who then took her to another guy's house, picked up a third guy, and they all went to a hotel room. Yeah, they all went to a hotel room. and went to that hotel for the purpose of renting a room so that she could conduct commercial sex acts, you know, also known as prostitution. And
she's here, a teenager,
just at 14, 15 years old.
Jeez, and it's like, man,
you think of, I mean, she's think of any child. 14, she is, she 100% was. And you know, what's sad and, you know, something that we see a lot of, sadly, a lot of young girls that find themselves in this life, there's never, and I'm very careful when I teach and explain this, is there's never a typical victim or a typical suspect, right? You can have it, gender, race, background, socioeconomics, all that. You can have the entire gambit. There's no type A, type B, type C. You can have it all. But with that said, with a lot of young girls, there are some red flags, and she had them. She was a chronic runaway, drug abuse, you know, things along those nature. So she kind of fell into this lifestyle of being out on the streets, and people prey on that. They really do. And they find those girls that are vulnerable, and that's what they did in this case. They ended up taking her to a hotel room. They ended up getting her to get one of her other friends involved, and who was also the same age. They went and picked her up from volleyball practice, unfortunately. And ended up taking these girls to the room, taking photos of them, you know, posting internet ads. And luckily, fortunately, thank God, it sounds like nothing actually happened in terms of, you know, guys coming to the hotel that night to conduct in that activity. But here in California, it doesn't matter. And that's a very positive thing that we have in California as far as our human trafficking laws, that if you even attempt to pimp or pander, which is basically procuring, encouraging, assisting, if you even attempt to do that with a juvenile, you are definitely guilty of human trafficking. So that was that was my first human trafficking experience. And honestly,
man, you would have nearly fell out of your seat. That's pretty full on experience, like, for straight up off the bat.
I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I couldn't believe the pain that it was causing. You know, there's so much that goes into these investigations, and so many layers with these victims that have been through so much trauma. And from there, I mean, yeah, exactly right. I was floored. I was nervous, you know, about doing this the right way, this big type of investigation. I was a little intimidated by it, and, you know, just wanting to do it right and do right for these victims. But at the end of the day, when all was said and done, and you know, weeks and weeks and weeks of investigation and court and all that, at the end of the day, it was worth it. And I think that's what really kind of sunk me into this. And from there,
you can sway the emotions. Hey, like
100%.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was what launched me into it. I guess about 7 years ago, 6 years ago.
God, what an introduction. Hey.
Hey.
Yeah. But it's full on. It's just like, you know, it's a global epidemic, you know, it's a $1 billion industry around the world. Like, when you're looking at trafficking and the people that are getting taken advantage of. And from what I've seen, like, online, this is just various numbers, right? You know, 27 million people at the moment are slaves worldwide. So, you know, California, it's a massive state when you're looking at, like, the population of California alone is bigger than what you can see in the map behind me here.
Oh,
is
it really? Okay.
Yeah. You guys are 40 mil. We're like 26. So, and we're a massive country.
Sure.
So yeah. But, it boggles my mind, you know, how big you guys are, but how condensed everything is. But what's the numbers like when you're looking at 40 mil, like the amount of trafficking that's going on in that state alone? 'Cause it seems like it's a bit of a hub for trafficking going, you know, when you got SoCal and NorCal, you know?
Yeah. And so the first thing I'll say, and what I always try to preach, and this is to community groups or parents or cops that I'm teaching, whoever it is, we have to be aware, but not panic. And the reason I say that is it's not so bad that on every single turn, you have to be worried about somebody getting snatched off the street. Or every single person you meet online isn't a trafficker. And I say that because I never want people to get too freaked out, paranoid, etc. That's one side. But the other side, which is important as well, is you do have to be aware. You do have to be aware of the people. And this really goes to the parents out there, right? You have to be aware of who your kids are interacting with, right? You know, are they starting to hang out with folks that they don't want to tell you about? That doesn't automatically mean human trafficking. That can be normal teenagers or, you know, they're out, you know, drinking beers, in a parking lot after school. But when you start to mix that with, okay, now is your, and I say girls or daughters more because most of what we see, especially with sex trafficking, is female victims. But I don't want to slight the fact and the notion that there are absolutely males that are victimized and just as badly and sadly. But just for me, when you hear me speak of, and I say girls or women, it's just mostly what I've seen.
Mainly women and kids. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, usually the most cases, and that's where I can speak about most intelligently, is the cases I've had. The victims tend to be female and they tend to be younger. So usually late teens, early 20s. And again, you know, some of those red flags and those things that people need to keep an eye on, right? Drugs and alcohol. That's one thing, you know. Number two, just being withdrawn. If a girl is having problems at home, you know, if there's family lives, broken homes, that kind of environment that's pushing them outside of the house and outside of, you know, maybe those usual norms of that household and that input from your parents. You know, the social media aspect of it, you know, I'm sure that's scary, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Social media.
You know, this lifestyle, right? The reason that exploiters are attracted to this lifestyle is the flashiness, the money, you know, the supposed notoriety that they feel in these small circles, the sense of power and control, right? That they exert over their victims. So, you know, certainly
it's crazy.
It is.
Just treating it like a marketplace, you know, like just how people are so disposable. It boggles my mind, you know, but how these people are just getting taken advantage this way, especially when you're talking about young women and kids. It's, you know, it's rife. It sucks.
And, you know, that's why I always preach. I don't want communities locally, people in California, people in Australia, people anywhere to panic and think, oh my gosh, you know, everybody's getting trafficked or anything like that. What I do want to preach and what I do want to say is we have to be aware of what's going on around us, and human trafficking does happen. And it is prevalent, and it comes in all different shapes and sizes and types. And, you know, the biggest thing that we can do to combat it is be educated about it, and have those conversations with our community, with our kids, et cetera, about some of the dangers that are out there.
And is a particular, like, are you saying people from particular countries that are coming through, like if they're getting traffic from up north, if you're looking at Canada to South Mexico and other countries that would be following through, because you got Mexico and then you got South America where they're all trailing through, you know, the south to the north. So are you seeing a lot of people from different countries sort of coming in and out of where you are?
Yeah. And I'll break it into two things. And one is going to be sex trafficking and the other is labor trafficking. And so with labor trafficking, you have a genre of crimes where people are essentially forcing other people to work, right? And and we see that in all kinds of different communities, especially California. I mean, we're a huge melting pot here, right? We have folks from everywhere. And that's, in my argument, what makes this place great is we have such good diversity. But with that, and with all those type of folks, different folks from all over the country, you get a lot of different industries here, right? And so you see labor trafficking sometimes in Hispanic communities that are working farm fields. You see labor trafficking sometimes in Asian communities that are doing sometimes restaurants, sometimes massage parlors, sometimes, you know, different types of businesses. So
That stuff happens here too.
I bet.
Yeah. When you're talking along the lines of some of those parlors and whatnot. So
and you know,
scary
it's
stuff.
It sucks because what people do is, you know, they prey on kind of that, the cliche American dream, right? Hey, I'm going to get you out of whatever country you're in. You're going to come to America and, you know, we're going to set you up with a place to live. You know, we'll even give you an opportunity to study, maybe learn English if you don't speak it, or, you know, we're going to set you up real nice. But what you don't know until you get here is you're expected to work 22 hours a day for a couple bucks a day, just to supposedly pay off, you know, your expenses for travel and such. So that's that labor trafficking side that, you know, we're always trying to be better at combating and dealing with, you know, regardless of what type it is or the community that it involves. You know, we're here for everybody. And then when it comes to the sex trafficking, mostly what we deal with here, you know, again, sometimes you have like the massage parlor type thing where tend to be usually Asian communities that victimize folks through those. But the sex trafficking, a lot of our victims, most of them, they're homegrown California girls or boys. You know, they're folks here in or from the United States, anywhere, that, you know, have had a lot of times those difficult childhoods, and exploiters are manipulators. They're controllers, and they see it. They see it on social media. I'll give you an example. One case that I worked, a young lady was going through some hard times, nothing too earth shattering, but it seemed to be in her perspective, right? You know, some family stuff was going on. And so she started posting on her Instagram about how she was sad and, you know, going through hard times and, you know, down and just not feeling great. Well, a guy she had went to high school with, saw that, right? And saw it as an opportunity and started messaging on Instagram, starting to make her feel better. It's going to be okay. Start befriending
her. Just buttering her up.
100%. It's 100%. It's no different. It's manipulation. It's controlled manipulation, right? And, you know, starting to reel her in and make her feel good about herself. And then eventually after time, starts rolling that into, well, hey, you know, I know money's a problem, right? You know, I know a way we can make some of that. And from there, you know, you start to, as an exploiter, you start to kind of try to get over that initial hump of asking about it and, okay, all right, now we're kind of talking about it. And then you normalize it because, unfortunately, because it does exist and it does happen a lot, you as an exploiter can be like, you know what, look how many people are doing it, right? It's okay. It's just a way that we'll make money. You don't have to do it if you don't want to. That's how they suck you in, right? Until then you start doing it and then you don't want to, and that's when bad things start to happen sometimes. So here in California,
and is it a lot of like kids and young people that are from those low socioeconomic areas, and when it's got to do with poverty and whatnot?
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, you'll see folks, and I'm kind of doing the Rolodex of the different cases that I've had. Sometimes,
yeah, and go deep, brother. Go deep, no, because I want to paint a realistic picture so people really get this at home, the listeners and the viewers, where this is what's going on in your backyard, and you want to, you know, you don't want to wrap your kids in cotton wool. Like, they're still got to have a life and live, but, you know, be aware this is what's going on. So, you know, give it to the audience, brother.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, as far as the socioeconomic piece, I think it plays into it at times. You know, I think anybody that grows up in poverty are going to have harder lives, harder life lessons. And sometimes if things aren't going right at home, it can kind of push you out to the street. But I got to tell you, human trafficking is a beast that knows no boundaries. And, you know, I worked a case where a beautiful young lady, 18 years old, never been in trouble, comes from a great home. Parents have a good job. She has a job, you know, doing successful in school. And she just happens to meet a guy that knows that he wants to pimp her out. And at first it's boyfriend, girlfriend, no big deal, going out on dates. But then again, if that exploiter goes into that relationship with that overall idea of, I want to sell this person for sex and make money from it, they're going to do all the things they can to seem like they're the nicest, most awesome boyfriend in the world, until they start to flirt that line of, well, I know we can make a little bit of money. We could go do this. We could go do that. And, you know, we'll just do it at your own pace and whatever you're comfortable with. And next thing you know, now the girl starts doing it, right? And, you know, there's two things that come into play. One, it's a lot of times, and I really recommend a couple books I'll share at the end that folks can go out and get. And that can get a true perspective from survivors of trafficking, because they have lived it, right? And they have been through it.
100%. And that's what I wanted to talk about. When you got people that are going through this horrific trauma, you know, and individuals that want to re-enter society, like when they got, like, when they've held onto these traumatic experiences and then trying to live life normal, like, is there, I don't know if it's with some of the programs that you're doing or there's other advocate agencies out there, because you'd have to, when you're talking about psychologists, psychiatrists, all that sort of stuff, just to try and normalize life again, especially if people have been trafficked for years on end and it's like, well, no, well, life is really like this, not where they might have had that normalized experience to do with when they were trafficked. And how, like, what's the reintegration process back in a normal society? That's a hard one.
Phew, man. I mean, and you hit the nail on the head. And so here's a couple things I'll share. And you know, I'm very open about this notion. For many years, us cops, law enforcement, we didn't get this right. We did not get this genre of law enforcement right. For a long time, right, it was all about prostitution. So, you know, and it was different, I would say, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, just on how this phenomenon kind of existed. But the idea back then was, well, these women, they have full control of what they're doing. They should be held criminally responsible for their prostitution. And that's how we're going to rid this problem, right? We're going to hold these prostitutes accountable. It doesn't work that way. And the reason why is these victims, they are being traumatized and victimized. So it's took a huge pendulum swing here in the States over the past 10 to 20 years to stop looking at commercial sex workers as suspects and prostitutes, but instead as victims. So that paradigm shift, it's still something we're going through. I'm going to tell you that right now. We're still working on it. But
it's a lot of PTSD, you know?
Oh, 100%. And that's the thing is, you got to realize, right? If I go talk to a commercial sex worker, a victim of human trafficking, 9 times out of 10, she's probably going to tell me to turn right back around and go back where I came from. And the reason why is a couple things. Number one, she could just be nervous around the police, right? Number two, though, and probably the most important, is she has been traumatized and she has built bonds. They call them trauma bonds between the person who has traumatized her and herself. And in a lot of ways with these victims, sadly, they sometimes don't identify as a victim. You know, they'll say, well, hold on a minute. I'm doing everything willingly. I just give my pimp the money. I just, you know, my pimp just gives me rides, but you know, he doesn't hold a gun to my head. Well, it's almost like a theoretical gun, because although he may not be holding a true gun to your head, maybe he's still controlling your finances. He's controlling when you can eat, when you can sleep, when you can go to the bathroom, and the list goes on from there, right? So these layers of trauma are stacking up on these victims. So us as cops, right? If I come up to you and you're a victim and I say, hey, who's your pimp and are you being victimized and are you a victim of human trafficking? You're going to look at me and say, what does that even mean? And no, of course I'm not. So those interactions with these commercial sex workers, they have to be based on understanding that there is trauma involved. And so the biggest thing, and I love them, and a huge shout out to them, victim advocates are the absolute best resource for law enforcement. So these are guys and gals that are out there that like work for, you know, some of the organizations, like you mentioned, just different nonprofits. Sometimes they work for public agencies. Like we have a set here in our county that are awesome, that work for the district attorney's office. But
they're working with you guys too.
Yes. Yes. And that's that's, you know, you hit that C word in the beginning, collective, right? Mm. So anytime, at least as long as it's feasible, that we're going to try to interview a victim of human trafficking, we bring an advocate with us. And in fact, I step out of the room completely for those first few minutes. And I just let that victim have a conversation with the advocate, because I want them to feel comfortable. I want them to know they are not in trouble at all. I want them to know that we're there to help them. So that's how you somewhat start to tear down those trauma layers. But you know, you'll hear from survivors and you'll read about it, that it can take years and years to work through that trauma, to try to reintegrate, you know, kind of back into normalcy and the flood of emotions. And I can't speak on it like they can, you know, because I haven't been through that experience, but just, you know, the interactions.
Especially if you got young kids.
Oh yeah.
You know, like I've heard, there was a story that I got told, not a story, it was reality, like where this woman, because the kids were rocking up to school, like when they'll get into school, the teacher, they'll twins, and the teacher noticed bruises on their wrists and on their legs, and they end up investigating it. And then what was going on was they found out that the mother, and this is local to me, here on the central coast, like I'm just north of Sydney, so where these youngsters, their mother was pimping them out, was selling them, was bringing men to the house. And when they sat down with the mother and were having the conversations, the mother had grown up and gone through the same circumstance. So it was just a vicious cycle, because she didn't know any better. Because she'd had gone through it as a child herself.
Yeah.
So then she'd put her own kids through this. And it's like they couldn't get through to her. And that's just... it just blows my mind. So you'd be coming across similar circumstances too, yeah?
And think about it, right? Like if you're if you have a norm in your family that you have dinner every Sunday, okay? And you know, hey, my family, you know, we get to, let's say we get together with our cousins and our grandparents, and every Sunday we have Sunday dinner, and that's a norm in your life, right? You're likely going to carry that norm forever. You're going to bestow that on your kids. You're going to teach them, hey, Sunday's the day we all come together and we have family dinner. So imagine now that that norm is you're getting sold for sex. And if that's what you grew up knowing, your mind, through all that trauma, starts to normalize it. And it becomes like the Sunday dinner. Like that's what that person grew up knowing. And it sucks. It's horrible. It's tragic.
That
right?
is so horrible.
It's wild to even fathom. But when we have to peel those layers back and say, well, how could this person sell their own children for sex, as wildly horrible as that is? But then when you kind of take a step back and you open that up and you try to unpack a little bit, well, that's what she knew, right? And if there was nobody there to help her through that, then it's likely she's going to reciprocate that behavior. So that's just another reason why, this phenomenon of combating human trafficking is such a big deal, because you don't want that to go on from generation to generation.
No way. And so how is it like when you're dealing with different states, or if it's different organizations, if say federally the FBI or other agencies get involved, is it sort of hard working with other organizations, or it can be seamless, or a bit of both?
Yeah, I would say both, any time, and it probably goes for any profession, if you have different folks that have different pieces of the puzzle trying to put that together. But we really believe in a collaborative approach. You know, here in this county, like I said, we have a district attorney's office who houses our human trafficking task force. And it's really the job of that task force, which I've been on now, I guess, for 3-4 years. It's our job to take a enhanced collaborative approach and work with other agencies, with federal agencies, with victim advocacy groups. And so it can be difficult, but at the end of the day, it's like anything else, right? If you check the ego at the door and you say, okay, hey, we're only here for two reasons. We're here to rescue victims, and we're here to hold exploiters accountable. All that other stuff kind of falls in line, and you just kind of get the job done.
100%. So you're an expert in your field. Talk to us about some of the training and the course that you've developed. Run us through it, brother.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. So a couple different things. You know, I teach law enforcement officers around the state through a couple different organizations. Primarily focusing on investigations as well as like proactive operations where, you know, we go out and try to look for victims and exploiters. And those are a kick in the pants. Those are a lot of fun, you know? So we'll, just to give you kind of an example of one type. So I don't know, does Australia have, we call them blades or tracks, but basically there are areas where commercial sex workers will like walk around and, you know, you can drive up and pick them up and that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's a bit of that. It's totally different though, because people still get exploited even when it's, cause over in Australia, it's legal like for, prostitution and where they got, brothels and whatnot throughout the nation. But people are still getting manipulated in those settings, whether they're people that have been brought from overseas and promised the world, whether it's education and whatnot, and they get thrown into those situations. So there's not, from what I understand, there's not so much like people working on the street, but they're getting manipulated when they're working in these registered commercial entities, these businesses, like they're legal to operate, but you got plenty of people that are still getting taken advantage of. But you still do have people throughout areas that where they're on the streets, but it's not like how it is in America. So because I think it's, what is it, only Nevada or a couple of states where they have legal brothels? Yeah.
So I mean, the closest place to us is Nevada that has the legal brothels. But with that, like you still, you know, you can't take your business outside. You know, it's still illegal to take prostitution, commercial sex you know, you can't walk around Las Vegas Strip and you know, try to pimp girls out there. We can't pimp girls anywhere, luckily, but it's still illegal to walk around for the purposes of prostitution. So like Nevada has those brothels, you know, definitely not here in California. But, you know, the reason I bring that up is it's a crazy phenomenon. And you know, you can YouTube a couple of different big blades. That's what they're referred to as blades, in California.
Yeah,
one's international in Oakland, and the other one's Figueroa down in LA. And you can
use Oakland's right near you. Yeah.
Yeah. It's 35 minutes away. Yeah. And you know, in fact, as kind of part of what we do, right. And every so often we'll take a drive out there, because we'll want to look for any of our victims, you know, that we're looking for at the time, see if they happen to be out and about there. And number two, it's just a kind of an educational piece because, I mean, these places are crazy, man. I mean, you'll have 25, 30, young ladies out walking around. Stopping cars in the middle of the streets and in their short little dresses, trying to get dates. And you can take a drive around that area and you can see the pimps just hanging out waiting, you know, to collect the money. And it's so hard because it's not like any of these police departments don't care about it. They do, and they do all the things they can to combat it. But when you have just so many and such a big problem, it becomes very difficult to deal with, right? So so sometimes we'll do proactive operations out on those areas. We'll try to do surveillance and try to figure out what guys are directing what girls, and those are always super, super crazy because it's busy. There's cars everywhere and girls everywhere. So you do your best. But so part of what I teach are some of these different type of operations and everything. But you know, one of the biggest things that, you know, I'm really focusing now, with folks is training our line level folks, right. Our patrol officers and those guys and gals that are going to the calls for service. Because here's the thing, no matter where you are, if it's Australia, the States, I don't care where you are in the world, right. Most of the time, and a lot of times, these exploiters and victims live together, okay? Under the guise of that it's a boyfriend, girlfriend, roommate type deal. Well, a lot of times in these relationships, there's violence. So you have police going to houses for what comes across as domestic violence. You know, maybe it's the victim calling in saying, hey, you know, my boyfriend, he hit me. Maybe it's a neighbor that calls in and says, hey, there's a huge ruckus at this house. Well, the cops get there and they're there. They want to do a good job. But they're only looking for the domestic violence stuff, right? They're looking for...
They're not seeing the rest of it. So it's trying to interpret what's going on.
Yes, because there's so much that goes into it. And, you know, what type of clothing is the victim wearing? What do they say? What do they talk about? Do they have expensive purses, expensive jewelry? Are they how is that victim reacting to the presence of that suspect? Are there any prior calls or law enforcement contacts involving prostitution? And it's all those things that go into it. So that's one of my biggest goals is teaching line level officers. And the second thing is, the thing about law enforcement, right, is that in probably any profession or group of folks that you're around, you tend to be really good at working with folks in your profession or your genre, but then you sometimes aren't as good working with people out of it. And that is one of the biggest things that us in law enforcement were constantly working on getting better is we want those two things: rescue victims, hold exploiters accountable. We do not like commercial sex exploiters by any means, right? And we want to rescue those victims. And sometimes we get tunnel vision on what we know we need to do as far as building a good case, etc. But we forget to get that input from the prosecutor, from the victim advocates, from the family of the victims, from the victims themselves. So I'm always harping. I'm always, always preaching and teaching. Hey, we need to understand this takes a whole village to correct this problem and to help somebody. So teaching police officers to, again, drop that ego at the door, just because you're the main investigator. Don't forget to bring everybody into this. You're going to get a better result. So I've been teaching, like I said, all over the state. I'll be teaching in Monterey next week, which is a beautiful coastal town here in California. And then I hope to be teaching at a couple different conferences around the country this year.
Super important. And, you know, for a lot of this work to be heard, and if you're going to be traveling like to different states, has there ever been any thought of, you know, because if it's working as a collective and if it's really pushing this program and the information spreading it out, have you thought of taking it to the United Nations in New York?
Yeah. So I follow a bunch of people, different platforms and stuff. You know, LinkedIn, that's how we hooked up, which is such a great platform. And all the time there, I'm meeting new people and seeing all the great work that's being done. And there's great work being done all over the place. And in fact, one gentleman that I follow on LinkedIn, he's a detective in Texas, like wears the cowboy hat and everything, right? And he's a huge combatant of human trafficking. And I noticed he posted a post that he is heading to Poland next week. To basically help over there with everything that's going on and teach Polish authorities on signs and symptoms of human trafficking, you know, because of all these folks from Ukraine that are fleeing there. So how cool is that, right?
Imagine, I know it's cool, but it's cool doing that. Yeah. But look, imagine the amount of people that are going to get taken advantage of, because you're looking at the majority that are leaving are women and children.
100%.
So these other countries, when all the men are in Ukraine, like fighting for their country. So, and you know, they're fighting, and who knows, you know, if the country settles up again and they're trying to find their family and loved ones, and who knows, they could have been trafficked or who knows what, you know?
Yeah. And so, you know, at least here in the States, you know, I've gotten to meet a lot of good people, and, you know, at every level, from local to state to federal and then international, the problem has been recognized, and we have a lot of good folks that are out there trying to deal with it. It's just finding that best way to do it. And so far, you know, there's been some successes, but we got some work to do. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. So is it just working with the DA and other organizations to keep your work rolling forward when it's spreading the important work of human trafficking and trying to educate people?
Yeah. And that's the biggest thing. It's getting people, excited about it. And I hate saying that in the sense, it'd be wonderful if there was no human trafficking, right? Like that.
Yeah.
I would love it. Right. And, I would much rather have a world that looked like that, but that's not the reality. And so getting people excited, in law enforcement to continue that fight. Right. And, you know, cause you gotta remember, movies and are a heck of a thing. So, you know, growing up, you become a cop, right? And you're like, okay, we're going to chase cars, and, you know, we're going to go after bad guys, and we're going to take down the big bosses of the world. And, you know, that you think
that's what I wanted to touch on. Yeah. Like when you're looking at the movie Taken, and then you got Liam Neeson going in, and where you've got these dens where you got all these girls chained up, and where you got these exploiters just feeding these girls full of heroin. So he's coming across stuff like that. Is there some substance of what's going on there?
So that's a super good question. So there's a couple myths, and I want to share this with you, because I think it's good for folks to know. There's a couple myths, misconceptions about human trafficking. One of the first ones is a lot of people hear human trafficking and they think that that's like the movement of humans, right? You hear traffic, you think of like, okay, I'm physically moving like in a vehicle in traffic. So I'm moving something from point A to B. That's smuggling. That's not trafficking. So that's a huge thing, that, and smuggling happens. We know that happens, and it's not to, not to, you know, say that that's not important, but it's just, it's not what human trafficking is. The second thing is like Taken, right? And the movies. Mm. When a lot of times with human trafficking, we automatically think, you know, oh my God, it's somebody being kidnapped off the street corner in some big city somewhere, and they're getting taken to a basement, tied up, shot with heroin, and basically just forced by drugs to do these unimaginable yeah. things. That happens. I'm not going to say it doesn't. And in one case that I worked, crazy, again, a teenage victim, she comes into the hotel room, and there's a dude in the corner, and he has the whole kit for heroin, right, laid out. So he's got the syringe, and he's got the spoon, and he's got the piece of ribbon to tie off his arm, right, mm-hmm. so he can get a vein in his arm. He's got the little cap where he heats up the heroin, shoots it into the needle. And she asks him what that is. And he's like, well, it's heroin. It makes you feel good. Do you want to try it? And for the first time in this girl's life, at an age of whatever, 15, 16 years old, she tries heroin for the first time. So that is a reality. That kind of horrible stuff does happen that you see in the movies, but that's not the norm, or not what you mostly see. The stuff that we mostly see are kind of what I've talked about. It's that grooming of folks, and that getting them into that lifestyle. But taking situations can happen, but they're, you know, again, no panicking, just being aware,
mate. And like, you know, if you're looking at the high end of town, if you're looking at Jeffrey Epstein and these individuals of high power, high money, worth, all of this sort of stuff, like, it's pretty full on when you're looking at people like that are taking advantage and swooping in, and private islands and all this crazy stuff. So in and around, you know, because there's a lot of money like within the area that you are, like when you're looking at the capital of California, Sacramento, and then you're looking at the Bay Area, you're looking at the tech hubs and all that sort of stuff. So a lot of money's, like, it's a massive economy. So are you seeing like a bit of the high end of town sort of preying on these people as well?
Yeah, it exists. But I think what's kind of sad that happens is, you know, those big cases, the high profile, the ones that involve the celebrities and such, they get a lot of attention, and rightfully so, because they're heinous crimes and there's victims in those crimes. But what tends to happen is that might be one out of 1,000. The other 999 are the young girls next door, the young girls you see in the grocery store, the young boys you see playing sports, just the victims that you see on a day in, day out basis that you just don't recognize, right, as human trafficking victims. And that's really, it's that push and that message forward that we want to understand, that, you know, the myth of, that's another myth of human trafficking, is it only happens in the big cities. So San Francisco or Oakland or, a big international city. That's not the case. It can happen in rural areas, small towns, suburbs. So definitely there's those sad, like, high end cases. But the case where a young girl gets picked up on a date for the first time, and by a guy she thinks is going to take him to the movies, but then ends up giving her ecstasy, taking her driver's license, and saying, you're going to do what I tell you to do, because now I know where you live. That's just as devastating. And I wish that each one of those could get attention, not to re-victimize the victims through, you know, it getting out there, which is why you never put out details and names and such like that. But I want those stories out there because I want people to be aware that's the reality.
Yeah, and talking about reality, have you been in one of those sticky situations when it's either you've been there or you've sent your boys out there when you've, you know, leading the SWAT teams or whatever it may be, and you get some of these grubby criminals that end up, you know, pulling out firearms and firing off at you guys and all that sort of crazy stuff?
Yeah, and, you know, it's one of those things we hope those days will never happen. But unfortunately they do. And I've seen it firsthand. you know, it sucks and it's sad. And, you know, that stuff does happen. So, yeah, I mean, those situations have been part of my career, sadly. And, you know, I've been to a lot of police officers' funerals, you know, over the years. And, you know, it's something that is very, beautiful in the sense of people coming together to remember somebody that lost their life in the line of duty. And it's something that you hope you never have to go to again, but you know that you're going to, right? And, it's a sad part of the reality of the job. And, you know, I would much rather have that any bad guy that we have to go arrest, I would just love for them to come and put the handcuffs on themselves. You know, it's just not the reality all the time.
Yeah, it's not. And, you know, but looking at on the brighter side of things, when you're looking at, and where you're talking about people getting excited for, you know, getting in these roles, and especially when it's got to do with what you're doing, human trafficking, and really joining the fight there and seeing where they can help a lot of people that are getting exploited out there throughout the country. So, because you're going to be traveling throughout the country and talking about this, so how can people get a hold of you, like organizations, individuals, when so they're aware of what's going on when you're going to be spreading the word of the important work that you're doing?
Yeah, no doubt. So me personally, you know, you and I are now connected on LinkedIn. I think that's a great spot. You know, if anybody wants to reach out to me, shoot me a connection, shoot me a message, and I'd love to chat and talk and be there for you for however, you know, I can. Here's what I recommend to folks is literally, Google is our easiest information sharing that's out there. I guarantee that at mostly anywhere you go in the world, somewhere hopefully nearby is some type of organization that deals with human trafficking, right? That allows volunteers to come in and get involved, whether it's working with victims or getting educated, taking a class, anything like that. So I highly recommend just researching your local community and typing in, mm-hmm. you know, human trafficking organizations near me, and something's going to pop up, something's going to come up, and you can do that. There's an organization called Polaris that is super important. They do a lot of great work domestically. So it's a huge one that I recommend. And then I want to show you two books if I can.
Yeah, the books. Yeah.
So I got my sticky notes going on here, but the first one
that's good
is In Pursuit of Love. And this is by a young lady named Rebecca Bender. And she was a victim of human trafficking. Some hellacious things happened to her. It takes place in Las Vegas. Mm. And she goes through her story of being involved in human trafficking. The very first chapter is called Vice Night, which is basically a night mm-hmm. where she was arrested for prostitution in Las Vegas. And then it goes through, you know, how she ended up in this lifestyle, the horrible experiences, and then breaking free of that. And I learned so much from her in this book. I reached out to her and exchanged an email or two, just thanking her for that book. So In Pursuit of Love, Rebecca Bender, I definitely recommend that. And secondly, this one, Stolen, by a young lady named Katrina Rosenblatt, who's now has her PhD. And this one is a wild journey as well, because it tells about her being a girl at, I want to say, it's been a little bit since I read it. I want to say she's at a pool at a hotel with family, when she meets actually and this is something we didn't really touch on. She meets another victim of human trafficking who is working for the exploiter to recruit other girls. So she gets befriended by this like older, pretty, you know, experienced, wise girl, right? And almost feels like an older sister. And then that's how she gets her into the lifestyle. So, like I said, it's not, you know, a lot of times we think male pimps female victims, but it ain't always the case, right? And so learning through journeys like hers and Rebecca's, that's how my number one thing would be, if you're interested in human trafficking and learning more about it, pick one of these up, because you're gonna get that firsthand account of what it's like.
That's awesome. And any last words, brother, before we wrap this up?
No, you know, I know that the topic is, it's a difficult one. There's not a lot of upbeat to it. But it's an important one, you know, and I just got to say, I commend you, Jake, for having someone on to talk about it. And I think it's one of those things where, you know, nobody wants to talk about it, but we have to. So I'm super appreciative of you having me on from many, many thousands of miles in a different time zones and different days. And I had a blast hanging out with you, man. I appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it, brother. You know, it's all about spreading the love. Hey, and one last one. I saw a bit of your jumper there. That said, Gracie, are you into jiu-jitsu?
Yeah, so that's kind of my hobby, my passion. I've been doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu for, 10, 11 years now, I want to say. So my gym that I go to is Crosley Gracie. And so he's a direct family member of the Gracie family from Brazil, a super big supporter of law enforcement, as all the Gracies are. So yeah, man, I guess Crosley, I'll have to make sure I let him know he's getting some free advertising shout out there.
That's it. And hey, one last one, make sure you watch Aussie Alexander Volkanovski fighting for the featherweight title next weekend, brother.
Without a doubt, man. Without a doubt.
All right. We really appreciate the time. And I know that this work's going to, you know, it's ongoing and it's going to grow. And I hope your message really gets out there, and I'll certainly be pushing it out there, brother. So
thanks, Jake. I appreciate it, man. Cheers.
Beauty. All right. See, folks, it's pretty full on. Women, children, men, getting exploited in California, the US, across the globe. $1 billion industry of human trafficking. It's great that we've got people like Kyle running task forces, stopping these criminals, and educating other professionals how to do it, enhancing their skills, but also dealing with the people that have been trafficked, that have gone through this trauma, re-entering society, which is no easy feat at all. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you decide to be a patron and want to roll with Squad, that'd be great. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at StraightRollingCheetah or email, one word, StraightRollingCheetah@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs. So check it out. And want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.